5 p.m. New York time.
Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 hello as always, and even more so today, to my wonderful, wonderful audience. Guess what? As usual, I'm in front of my, I don't know what it is, 8 feet wide window, glass, beautiful, looking out on my three bird feeders. Birds coming and going. Today is almost always we're having a goldfinch feast. Goldfinch feast outside my window. And yes, I am the conscience of psychiatry. This is the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. It's September 25th, 2019, 4 p.m. New York time. If that's the time you are, you can call in. And this is Open Mic Wednesday, the last Wednesday of the month. That means, folks, that you can call in about anything you want. You call in at 888-874-4888. Call in. Call in now so I can see the lineup, because I'm going to talk about something pretty interesting. But I don't want to fill the hour with me. This is the hour to fill with you. Fill it up, all of you out there. Line up like airplanes, and I'll be your whatever those guys are up in the towers, controlling what goes on and helping you line up and land on the radio show. Okay? 888-874-4888. The Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. The daily breaking news on my website, which is breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com. The breaking daily news today, thanks to my wonderful assistant, Ian, was really breaking news for me. And I want to tell you about that and remind you that you would have had an alert to this show if you got my frequent alerts. Get my frequent alerts. They're free on Breggin.com. Means a lot to me to have you get those frequent alerts. It means you really care. You're really listening. I should keep on communicating and just go on communicating forever. Well, what I learned, because Ian had his alert ear to the ground, his sharp eye to the, I don't know, where has he got his sharp eye? I guess to the all the material coming in through his computer. He's got his, you know, nose to the air, whatever else. He gets stuff. And what he got goes back to 1994 to the most, well, probably not the most, it's the second most important trial, maybe event of my career, and certainly the most disillusioning, without a question, the most disillusioning. And thank you, the calls are already coming in. Thank you for Linda to call in first and just, you know, line up a few here. And believe me, if I get too many calls, I will then announce that so you won't be left hanging. This was what I'm talking about, was the Joseph Westbecker trial. And the trial would involve me as the expert assigned by a federal court, appointed by some attorneys, and then confirmed by a federal court, where I was the single scientific expert for all the 160 combined Prozac suits. Me. I know now that trial, the first one to come on, was kind of the Great Wall that might have stopped Eli Lilly from its fraudulent promotion and distribution of Prozac. That might have led to stopping Zoloft and Paxil and Lexapro and so on. That was a big deal, that trial. It was me. I thought me against Eli Lilly. No, it wasn't me against Eli Lilly. The thing had been fixed. Here I am, the expert for 160 suits. The first suit is coming up under the guidance of the attorney, who was the lead attorney for all the others, selected his suit to go first. And I'm in the courtroom. I'm going down to Louisville, Kentucky to do this. And it turns out not to be me against Eli Lilly, but me against the attorneys who hired me. Actually, it wasn't the attorneys who hired me. That attorney died. That would be interesting to know more about. But it was his replacement attorney. Me against his replacement attorney, a man named Smith, Joe Smith. And Joe Smith had created with Eli Lilly a fake trial. Two purposes. Stop all these lawsuits that were lined up by winning this one. Then everybody else would settle, they thought, and they were right. And get Bregan, make him look incompetent and disabled and unable and too young. I was pretty young then. And then they could go on about their business. A big key to the trial was the information I would have when I went on the stand. I was given no information. I was given no practice. Ginger announced, and they put me in a hotel that was miles away from the hotel where the lawyers on our side were staying, with the lawyers on their side. Their side in the hotel. Everybody's there but me. Fortunately, at least for my dignity, if nothing else, I got there a day early, and I insisted upon going into the lawyer's office. He said, "Oh, stay at home. I'm coming in." I came in. I said, "I'm going through your stuff." And I found out that an entire huge discovery had done. Eli Lilly had done 20 depositions. I'd been given none of them. And then I dug out of the files a huge chronology that Eli Lilly had made of this mass murderer, Wes Becker's, childhood, which I hadn't been given. I was stunned. I demanded, of course, a copy of this. They refused. I said, "Well, I can't." I just walked in and got it copied. So now I have it. I don't know what's going on. Ginger says the trial's been fixed. She's at home. Trial's been fixed. That night before my testimony, I'm sitting with the attorneys, the assembled attorneys for the people, and I'll tell you this background, there were a large number of people suing Eli Lilly around a mass murder in Louisville, Kentucky, in a place of business, a printer. That also was fixed because the first trial to go, the first case to go into trial, was a terrible case. I told them I could only partially support the case. I refused to do a malpractice against the psychiatrist because he couldn't have had the information Lilly was hiding. And I told him I couldn't say Lilly was the sole cause, that their drug, because the man had voiced violence and been hospitalized before he ever got on the drug. Worst possible case coming first. It was all fixed, even the sequence of the cases. But I said that since he was never psychotic the way he was when he went on Prozac, and since the doctor recognized in the first month that this drug was probably making him psychotic and had stopped the drug, and since 3 days later, still loaded up with Prozac, the man had committed this mass murder based on a frank psychotic delusion of public sexual abuse in front of the entire group of workers with all the bosses there. We knew that was psychotic. I said, "I'll say that it pushed him over." This enraged them. You know why it enraged them? Because it was reasonable. You could have won with an argument like that. That it was a contributing factor from Prozac. Well, I get up to do my testimony. And by the way, keep calling in, folks. We got a couple of people lined up. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We're going back to late 1994. I'm on the witness stand. I'm against Eli Lilly. I'm testifying that the Prozac pushed this man over into mass murder. I think he killed 8 people, wounded 12. And killed himself. It's a product liability against Eli Lilly. Could have, way back in the late 94, have disrupted this whole massive thing that's gone on, including additional mass shootings on these drugs, on Prozac and other drugs. Could have stopped it all, slowed it down, called some sort of inquiry, investigation. And I'm going up on the witness stand, and contrary to all the rules of how you be a lawyer, I was not given any questions he was going to ask me. He was going to give me spontaneous questions because I was so good I could answer without preparation. I knew that was crazy. And I said, night before, I said to the lawyers together, there was a bunch of them, I said, you guys haven't practiced me, something weird's going on here. So they joked and laughed, they asked me a couple of questions, said how great I was. So I get up on the stand, and I've given him a bunch of cards, and I've said, you had better ask me the questions on these cards. That's how bad it was. So he asked me a few of the questions on the cards, I think because he didn't want me maybe turning to the judge and say, what's going on here, Your Honor, or going to the papers or something. So he asked me some of those questions, but not the biggest ones. Some of the biggest ones were left out. I started asking myself and answering questions. It's kind of weird to see it. When I read over the transcript, I'm sort of saying, and furthermore, answering, making up and answering my questions, but it was not good. At the end of my testimony, I felt like it had not gone well, of course, but it had gone somewhat well simply because I'd forced through a whole bunch of questions. I'd gone on about them. It would be hard for him to interrupt me talking importantly about his case. Then comes the cross-exam. And at first the guy starts out bullying me and badgering me and leaning against me practically on the witness stand. I actually had to say to the judge, I'm being badgered, Your Honor. That's how bad it was. I had to say, the judge said, yes, you are, back off, sir. So what does he question me about? He never asked me a question about science. He doesn't want to deal with me around the science. Doesn't ask me a question about Eli Lilly. He doesn't cross-examine me on my testimony. On the cross-exam. By the way, these guys were the tobacco attorneys, Shicardi and Bacon, the ones who kept people smoking tobacco so long by managing again and again to win in court. So Shicardi and Bacon's big guy. What does he question me about? He goes after me on Wes Becker's childhood, that big, long chronology that the attorney didn't want me to have on my side, and which I brought to the witness stand on my own. I don't know whether he had said to him, hey, you got to change your strategy, Bregan's actually got the chronology, or whether not. But you know, these big-time attorneys, they're very rigid and compulsive often. They're used to having their way. They're like, you know, serial murderers and serial rapists, all of these big attorneys. They're used to just mauling people on the stand. So they're not used to flexibility necessarily, adapting to a new situation. Well, they had a real new situation because here I was being questioned about their childhood of Wes Becker, most of their questions, many of them, and I've got the exact answers in front of me. It was very strange. It was weird. It was not joyful. It was not triumphant, but I did my very best during the course. Oh, it was to say the least, a deeply distressing situation. When I got off the stand, Joseph Smith, the attorney that was supposedly on my supposedly working with me against Lily, was just enraged at me, and I kept saying, "Why are you enraged?" I just couldn't grasp it. I was thinking, "This guy is, what is he? Is he incompetent? Is he having a nervous breakdown dealing with Eli Lilly?" I couldn't believe what Ginger had said to me, which is, "It's all fixed." Well, we almost had a hung jury, despite all the stuff that Lily had done and the way they kept me from testifying and so on. We had three people side with my testimony and say Lily had committed fraud. They would have, but that was 9-3 meant a victory for Lily. One more, we would have won. Press never reported that. They just reported great victory for Eli Lilly. I just decided I wasn't going to do any more legal work. I talked to other people about it. And somewhere about, a year later, a lawyer said to me, "Have you seen the write-up in the this law review?" It's actually kind of a newspaper. It's called Kentucky Fried Verdict. They said, "The trial was fixed." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, Yes. People talked to the judge. So one of the jurors going up to the judge during the trial and saying he'd overheard something about a settlement being discussed out in the hallway by the lawyers. They were talking about it. So the judge had called them in the trial, after my testimony, I think. They called them in and said, "Did you guys have a settlement?" "No, sir." "Did you guys exchange any money?" "No, sir." All right, trial goes on. Well, what happened was that after the trial that supposedly was won by Eli Lilly, it was discovered that a lot of the people who'd been in the trial, involved in, a number of them, went through divorces. That happens. If you have 20 people in a group and they've been involved with the death of loved ones by this kind of traumatic thing, there'll be a couple of divorces very likely. Well, it turned out, news came out, these people had a lot of money. A lot of money. And I'm going to tell you how much in a minute, because that's what Ian found out when he found the newspaper. Well, the judge interviewed everybody, and they did an inquiry, and it was discovered that Eli Lilly had fixed the trial. The judge didn't want to believe that they'd fixed it before me, long before my testimony. They'd fixed it probably 10 months earlier. He didn't want to hear from me about that. I sent him messages and stuff. He wanted to think it happened just on the spot. But the Lilly appealed, and Smith appealed the judge's decision that the trial had been fixed, that it was fraudulent or nearly fraudulent, and that he changed it to a settlement with prejudice against Eli Lilly, meaning they couldn't appeal. But they appealed against the judge's decision, and the Supreme Court of Kentucky said there was possible fraud, definitely deception upon the part of Eli Lilly, and they agreed with overturning the trial. That wasn't reported by a single major newspaper. They'd all reported the victory, but not a single one. So then the judge went back and said, "Now I want to know how much money you guys settled for." And they said, "Oh, we can't tell you that, because that would be prejudicial to Eli Lilly. And besides, you're prejudiced against you because we lied to you. So we need a new judge." So they got a new judge, and the new judge said, "No, it's too much money involved. We're not going to tell you." Well, what we now know is that Eli Lilly paid $20 million to Joseph Smith and his clients, really directly to his clients. That just came out. A newspaper in Kentucky got that information. We have it up on the website. Go to Daily Breaking News. Now, how much did Joseph Smith, who went to such great extreme to fix this trial, would have gotten? Well, you figure if he gets 30% plus expenses, covers all his expenses, remember, let's suppose he gets a modest 30% of a $20 million verdict. That's enough to set him up for the rest of his life. Sounds like $6 million bucks. A lot of motivation. It was so disillusioning. I can't tell you how disillusioning this whole experience has been. I finally decided to, what I've always done. When I was a kid in high school, some big bully attacked me. I just really got tough. I got tough. And I got left alone most of the time. Well, I got tough, and so I've been doing tough legal work ever since. But I've run into corruption again and again in that process. Corruption I cannot talk about. Mainly because it's just the experience of what happened. I'd say 3 or 4 times. So it was interesting. Thank you, Ian, again, for discovering that the amount that passed hands those years ago. And by the way, that $20 million, if you figure in inflation and all, in 1994, it'd be a ton of money more now. I don't know how much more. I should have checked and tried to figure it out. But it's hard because I think these kind of awards have escalated beyond inflation. But I wouldn't be surprised to... would have been up around $50 million equivalent nowadays. I have an interesting life, folks. I'm going to talk more about this case because it's not the end of it, but not today. Today, I'm going to now start to take a deep breath, take 3 deep breaths, tell you that it's interesting to have people to talk to about this. I think having my wonderful audience will inspire me to do a series of blogs maybe on this case with this new information out. So in summary, Eli Lilly paid some lawyers, so Smith wouldn't have gotten it all by any means, all that, whatever the lawyers got. Paid a bunch of lawyers to pay off the plaintiffs in the case against Eli Lilly and then to fake a trial. And in the process to get Bregan, by totally not preparing him for a subject about which he would be questioned in detail without his even knowing beforehand there was any knowledge about his Westbecker's childhood, let alone there may be a dozen depositions of the 20 about his childhood. Welcome to American jurisprudence, folks. Listen, remember you can email me with your thoughts. So the 2 things I'd love you to do is get my frequent alerts, listen to the show, of course, look at the daily breaking news on my website, but also to email me at my website, BreganLive@hotmail.com. Bregan Live. It's dedicated to you guys. I don't give it out anywhere except on this radio show. Nowhere else. BreganLive@hotmail.com. Let me know what you think of this story. Share your feelings with me. Perk me up. I really am so glad to be connecting to all of you today. Linda in New Jersey. Let's see if our texts, Jess, Alex, our wonderful texts are alert. Let's go to the phones, call number 1, Linda in New Jersey. Linda, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can, Linda, and that means that the wonderful people who man the studio are alert, too. Hi, you've been listening to this show?
I have, ever since I heard about it, and ever since I heard about you only a few months ago. And I have to just tell you, it's an honor to be speaking with you. I have purchased books. I have been listening, and anything I could do, YouTube, whatever, to get any information, everything that you're saying, because I've lived this life, Dr. Bregan, for about 20 years. I was in the system, addicted to all the horrible, horrible things, and now I just want to live my life and do what you're doing. From a perspective of the patient side, I want to do what you're doing because you're my hero.
Thank you, Linda. Thank you. There are so many things people can do. By the way, folks, I didn't mention that there's a lengthy description on my part on the Westbecker case. It's got everything in it other than this $20 million payoff. And it's in Medication Madness, my not very expensive paperback, Medication Madness. That and Toxic Psychiatry are in some ways my most well-written books, Medication Madness and Toxic Psychiatry. Well, I hope you figure out some stuff to do, Linda. Have you thought about what you could do to really get involved in this?
Well, the only thing is, because I am a stay-at-home mom, I mean, my kids are grown now, but they do still live at home as they're going to college. But, you know, I have a husband that works a lot, and I want to try to, you know, regain a lot of lost years where I wasn't with it. I was not in my right mind. So I'm trying to just do the best I can at living life and becoming a person again, because that's what happens when you come off of these terrible things. You actually begin to realize that you are indeed a person. It's been a horrible, horrible thing that I went through, and I'm actually in my car. I'm almost to my home, and I was just with a good friend of mine. I've known her for 20-something years, and this is what I told the man when I called that I wanted to speak about. I've known her for 20-something years. She is on such a long list of medications, and I know about that, and I know, so, like, I can spend time with her, and I understand where she's at in her mind. I understand that, you know, just going out to a salad works to get a salad and ordering at the counter is a big ordeal. I understand that. So I just want to help her because I know she doesn't have the money. You did a show not too long ago, and you had this wonderful person on that talked about a place, I think it was in Vermont, where people could go and actually detox from all of these medications. But like I said, I don't have the funds myself, and she doesn't because she's on a fixed income, living in a Section 8 housing, and her life is not her own. So I would love to help her and other people that are stuck in the system like she is. And yeah, Medication Madness was the first book I got of yours. I actually got two copies from my library because I didn't realize it was the same book. And then I went and purchased your book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, for the reason of doing this, like helping people to come off of them. I would love to meet in person someday, you and Ginger. I would take the trip. I love driving, and I would take the trip from Central Jersey up to where you are. I'm sure it's beautiful, and as you describe it.
Well, maybe at some point I'll do a workshop up here in my own locale. That might be, because many people would like to come and meet me and talk to me, and maybe if I planned it ahead of time, maybe some of you could let me know whether if I planned a workshop up here for a few days, maybe just a weekend in Ithaca, New York, if folks would be interested in coming up. And I could think about that for the future. That might be a nice idea, Linda. Have you gotten psychiatric? I don't remember. Did you get psychiatric drug withdrawal too, or just the Med Madness?
The book, yeah. I purchased the book, Psychiatric drug withdrawal. And I also, I have right now a copy of Medication Madness out from my library. The only thing is my life is so busy now because my life was on hold. I didn't have a life for like 20 years. So now I've just been out and about and busy doing life. I haven't had as much time as I would like for reading.
I think that's wonderful, by the way. And how long have you been off meds?
For about a year and a half, I guess, totally. But it was a long process. It took me about 10 years from the time I started with a naturopathic doctor and, you know, coming off and, you know, I know you know about this. Just it was a nightmare for 10 years trying to get off of them. I have stories upon stories upon stories, but so for the last time, the last two hospitalizations I had, I actually, it was pretty much voluntarily. So, but you know what happens then. There's nothing voluntary when it comes to this because you sign yourself in voluntarily and then you get committed. And what you were just saying before about the Eli Lilly, boy, I have a story for you. I have a phone call I'd like to share with you sometime that I recorded that I recently called the Division of Mental Health here in New Jersey. And it's sad because I felt bad for the woman I was talking to on the phone because she had no clue. She had no clue what she was involved in. Because I was bringing up the fact about court cases in it when you're committed to a psych hospital. And it's a joke. It's a joke. And like what you were just saying about Eli Lilly, it's a fixed thing. They're just going in there and they're telling you how much time you have to stay according to how much your insurance is going to pay. That's all it's about. I can tell you so much, and I know, you know, you know so much from your end, but I would love to someday tell you because, you know, I don't know, Dr. Bragan, but you tell me, I feel like there's not many people who are able to get to the other side like I have and are totally in their right.
You're
mind
breaking
now,
up a little, Linda.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Linda,
can you hear me now?
Are you driving right now? You said you were driving.
I'm driving, but I'm on Bluetooth. But I can pull over in a second, and then I could put you into my earbuds, and that will be a better connection.
Yeah, and I would feel safer if you weren't driving when you were talking about such emotionally significant things. I'd feel safer and better if you would pull over.
Oh, I hear you. I will. And you know what? But I don't get it. I mean, this is a good thing and a bad thing. Oh, I'm in total stop traffic now, so this is good. It's a good thing and a bad thing. I don't get emotional about this stuff. I can be detached from it now, and I can talk from it. I can actually talk about it, like, as in a third-person way, like I did with this person on the phone with the New Jersey Division of Mental Illness.
Well, even so, Linda, even so, I wouldn't like to be talking to you on the phone because I know this call matters to you and you're going to be focused and
I'm
focused and I'd love you to stop.
Stuck.
All right. Are you going to get off the road?
Yep, I'm off.
Oh, good. Are you still driving?
Well, I'm sitting here in totally stopped traffic.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll keep talking. Have you ever written anything about this? Especially about, you know what, I think it would be wonderful if you would just write anything I could read. It doesn't have to be a finished thing. But if you would write something about more about how these drugs impaired your loving and engaging and being with your family and how you're rediscovering that, because I want to write about that too. I am writing about that. And it could be helpful to me. I might be able to, with your permission or just anonymously, include some of what you're writing or saying to me. But even if I didn't, it would be useful to me. I think that what you're discussing is one of the single most important things that people should know about these drugs and don't, which is that they take the edge off your ability to love. They take the edge off everything. But the ability to love can be pretty fragile. You know, I mean, it's hard to be loving when you have the flu. It's hard to be loving when you're tired. It's hard to be loving when you're worn out or preoccupied. And couples who love each other have to remind each other to, hey, come back and love me. I know you're preoccupied with what's going on, but I need your love. And people need each other's love a lot, and it is fragile from moment to moment, not necessarily long-term. Even in a good long-term relationship, it can be fragile from moment to moment. Well, psychiatric drugs with the first dose can be sufficiently neurotoxic to interfere with the ability to love. So I think it would be wonderful if you would write down some stuff about your experience of having difficulty being engaged with, in touch with, caring, attentive to, oriented to your family, and then the gradual change coming off the drugs, and then the final change you're in now, where you are talking, you know, so seriously about engaging with your family, whom you feel you have not given what you wanted to. What would you think about writing something, and you could email it to me at my email.
Yes, the Hotmail. Yeah, the Hotmail email.
Hotmail.
Bregan Live. Yes, I did that last week after the show last week. I emailed you with exactly what you're describing, a lot of information. But
now you know that I haven't looked at that yet.
That's fine. You're a busy man, and I'm so thankful to have met you and beyond thankful that I'm talking to you. And can I just share, because exactly what you're saying, I don't mind at all. I would be honored that if you would use my name. My life is an open book. I tell that to everybody I meet. I went through everything I went through for a reason, and that main reason is to help others so that they don't have to go through the same. Can I just share, the first time I got addicted to the stuff, I had my second child. She was only 3 months old, and that's a long story as to why I got put into one of these hospitals. I got taken away and put in and got a diagnosis, and you know, there was hormones going on there. I was nursing my baby, taking care of my three-year-old son, whatever. They put me on so many things that only 6 months later, I was so out of my mind and wanting to die that it looked like I was going to commit suicide. So that was the start. Yeah, that was the start. And then it just went, it just kept, you know, it was horrible. It was a roller coaster ride for 20 years.
Did they diagnose you with postpartum depression or something like that?
No, because I was happier than a pig in mud. Because I was able to walk and take care of my baby and my son. No, they diagnosed me with bipolar, like everybody else that was put in the hospital I was put into.
Yeah, yeah. That, you know why they diagnose everybody with bipolar, Linda?
No, why?
It's because then you can give any drug you want, because you've got mania and depression, and that sort of covers, and of course there's always anxiety wrapped in and so on. So it gives them a carte blanche to just drug the heck out of you with anything they want. It's the perfect psychiatric diagnosis, also perfect for the drug companies. So the drug companies have pushed it tremendously because it enables the doctor's tendency to put you on multiple drugs.
That makes
sense.
It's
like having a dual diagnosis. You're both depressed and manic, and then a couple of other things thrown in, you know.
Yeah, and that's why I was on that roller coaster. I was either so high, manic, that I was just doing crazy things that my husband, poor husband, didn't know what was going on, and he just believed what they told him. They told him that I was just going to do this, go mania, and then go to severe depression, and it just kept going on and on, and back and forth, and then, of course, they were giving me antipsychotics, and you know what that does to you? That makes you a psychotic. I tell everybody, antidepressants, when you have no problem, or even if you do, probably, they make you depressed. Antipsychotics make you psychotic.
And anti-anxiety drugs make you anxious. Isn't it crazy, this world we're in?
It is. It is so crazy, so crazy. And Dr. Bregan, I don't know. I mean, I might be like, I don't know. Like I said, I'm just coming back into the world myself, but
I feel like you're the only one. You're the only one. I only found out about you a few months ago. And you're the only one talking like this.
Well, right? You pay a price. I mean, look at what happened to me around the Westbecker case. They really tried to humiliate me, make me look like I didn't know what I was doing in court. I find myself up against not only Eli Lilly, but the attorneys who hired me. So once you step into this reform place that I'm in, you have to be prepared to just, I don't know, just what do you have to be? You have to be prepared to live and die around it, you know?
Well, you're putting your life on the line, that's for sure. And ever since I heard about you, I've been praying for you every day.
Oh, bless you. Thank you, Linda.
Well,
is lovely. Thank you very, very, very much, Linda. When I knew I was going to talk about Westbecker today, I actually got kind of stressed out. This is just not like, you know, wonderful, triumphant to be in this place. It's more like, oh, my God, what is this world about? And yet I'm happy, man. I have love in my life, and that's a source of the main happiness we can have. I have a very full and rich life. But when I think back about the various stages and I think about what may be in the future, you know, it's interesting, to say the least. Linda, thank you for being on the show. Call again. Thank you for emailing me. I'll take a look at what you wrote me. And let's go to Alice in New Jersey, who's withdrawing from drugs. Alice, hello.
Hello?
Hi, Alice.
Hi, Dr. Bregging. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you. So I recently came across your book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, and I've also read Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. I have been on antidepressants for about 10 years, and now I'm trying to withdraw. And I was hoping you could give me some advice on how to do it in the safest way possible.
Well, I can't do a medical consult, but I can talk with you in general and about things. I think reading my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, is one of the most important thing you could do. And then look to see, as the book recommends, whether you can develop a social network for yourself, or at least one person who is in regular daily touch with you about how you're doing. And find a counselor, if not a physician, to supervise you, and if you can find that somehow. See, ideally, if you could find, who's giving you your meds? Let's start with that.
So I'm seeing a prescriber. She is on board with trying to take me off of medications, and but right now I struggle most with insomnia, so I find it very hard to go without the occasional Klonopin and Trizodone, which I am concerned about because they are quite...
Well, is that what you're on, or are there other meds too?
Yeah, so that's what I am on, Trizodone and Klonopin.
So first of all, you have the prescriber is a woman, a psychiatrist, a physician, a nurse practitioner?
A woman psychiatrist.
And she's helping you come off. That's wonderful. That is wonderful. How often do you see her?
I see her once every 2 weeks.
So twice a month. And does she talk with you, spend any time with you?
Yes, she is. She was better than my previous psychiatrist at listening to me and understanding that I would like to withdraw.
Well, that's terrific. That's wonderful. And what did you come off so far?
Before I was 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with depression And then the diagnosis changed to bipolar 2. And I was given combination of Abilify, Wellbutrin, and Gabapentin.
So you had a few drugs to come off.
Yeah.
And right now, and do you have a family member or a friend who knows about your withdrawal and keeps you company, checks in once in a while, asks how you're doing?
Yeah. My family is quite supportive. With my friends, I cannot talk to them about this because there is stigma around mental health, and I would prefer they did not know about it.
Oh, well, that's fine, and it's wonderful you have your family. So you've got a good back basis for you. So tell me, what is the struggle you're having? You're on two drugs that you take them. Can you as accurately as possible say how often you take each one?
So I take 0.25 milligrams of clonopin to go to, for going to sleep. I take it at around 10. I combine it with melatonin, like 10 milligrams of melatonin, and I also use 25 milligrams of trazodone. And that helps me sleep through the day without...
So you're just taking 0.25. You're down to a low dose of clonazepam.
Yes.
And 25 milligrams of trazodone.
Yes.
Which is, like a starting dose. It's common to give 25 or 50 for sleep, but some people give more. And yeah. How often do you use it?
I use it often on, like, when my anxiety about, at night I lie in bed and I think very depressing thoughts, and I think we will all, be gone at some point. So death is inevitable, and I think things like the very depressing thoughts, and then I find that I need to take the clonopin in order to put these thoughts to rest.
At night?
Yes.
And do you get, all right, are you working on this in therapy, on the thoughts?
Yes, but it's a very slow process.
Yes,
and
I understand.
I know that,
Well, first of all, congratulations on getting off of everything else. Oh, by the way, let me say, my dear friend out in California, who is on the waiting, I won't get to you today. Send me an email. But I will be, I'm going to finish with Alice, and I will get a chance to talk to Maria from Michigan, and that will be it for today. Maria from Michigan, and hi, Sarah.
Hello?
I think with time, are you there? You said hello?
Hello. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, Dr. Breckin. Yes, hello?
Yeah, are you still there, Alice?
Yes, I'm here. I wanted to wait for your comment.
Yeah, Alice, I think that what you might talk to with your psychiatrist about is mm-hmm. that probably it's going to be easiest to get off the trazodone.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you could work with her on that while you work with her on the issue of the sleep, and take a good look at the guilt, shame, and anxiety book, and mm-hmm. and see if it can help you understand what some of these negative thoughts are coming from.
Yeah.
And I would say work on the trazodone with her. And that's
okay,
about my main thought right now. And congratulations on on coming off as far as you have. I think that being on these low doses, you'll be able to get yourself off. I really encourage you to continue with it, with the supervision. Okay, any last question?
No, I'm Yes.
Thank you. Thank you,
yeah.
Alice. Let's go to Maria in Michigan. Maria, call number 3 in Michigan. Are you there?
Yes. Dr. Bergen? Okay, I need to turn the radio show off, right?
I think I hear that helps sometimes, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I met you, and you were also my doctor. I met you and Ginger and quite a few years, well, at one of the empathic conferences.
Yeah, was it more than 20 years ago, or is it more recently than that?
Well, you were testified for me in 2002.
Oh, hello. Okay.
and Mr. Mosher was my attorney.
Yes,
and that
hello.
Is when I first found out that you were not board certified. Well, board certified meant there was a precedent set in Michigan. And because you weren't board certified, we ran out of time. But I also realized then that board certified meant that you weren't part of the pack, because what I consider psychiatrists today.
Now, I don't remember any of this, Maria. So 2002 is a long time in my life, as long as it is still
a long
time.
Yes.
So I don't remember any of this. I don't remember that Michigan has a statute about board certification, but some states do. I know that. Folks, what she's referring to is that let me speak for a minute, Maria. Some states won't allow a doctor to testify against another doctor if he's not board certified in his specialty. I decided a long time ago not to take the boards when I got out of, as Maria is suggesting, when I got out of my training, and I knew that was going to be one more time when I had to go through something I didn't believe in, and I didn't feel I had to believe in it anymore. I had taken the National Board of Medical Examiners, which was for licensure in the States, and I'd gotten the highest grade in the country on psychiatry. Just to let you know, I wasn't afraid of the boards. I'd gotten 99 out of 100.
Actually,
but Maria, why are you calling? What are you calling about?
I believe that you're not part of the pack.
I'm not part of the pack. I've never been part of the pack.
Correct. And I'm happy that you're going to have a conference in Columbus, because I loved, I went to a couple of them. I know you were in Canada, but basically I consider psychiatry today, most psychiatrists are nothing but legal pimps. I'm sorry that I have to say it this way, but this is how I feel.
Maria, I didn't hear your second word. They are no more than legal what?
Pimps.
Pimps.
Yes.
I don't know if the pimps are going to be so happy with that comparison.
Well, but for 3 minutes... they would just write a prescription, not talk to you, not even look at you, and make $250 for 3 minutes. This is, and prescribe like crazy. But my question, and I really appreciated your comment about love, because I'm sure you're familiar with it. I hope I pronounced his name right, Eli Wiesel, the
yes.
Holocaust survivor.
Yes, he
said something similar. He said most people who are depressed or whatever have no meaning in life. So sort of on the same subject, correct?
Well, I think that's really true. I think that most of what we suffer from in life, Maria, is opening our hearts, despite how difficult life can be and our losses, and despite the trauma of childhood.
You are so real, because I had the fortune of talking to Ginger and you for a long time, in 2011. So you are everything that you say you are. I do have a question, and perhaps, I've read all your books. The latest one on withdrawals is phenomenal. But what I have a question on is, do you personally believe that drugs could cause actual mental illness?
Oh, no doubt about it. Let's not say mental illness, because that's really a foggy, horrible concept. Drugs cause harm to the brain, and that causes disturbances in how we think and feel. Every psychiatric drug, if it's working at all, which it usually does with the first dose, is causing harm to the brain. Because, Maria, they're neurotoxins. They are poisonous to the brain. They're not good for it. By the way, I want to take a minute and apologize for making a sort of crude joke about it's an insult to the pimps, because I don't like pimps either. I don't like anything that involves the abuse
and
using of women.
But I
agree with you that psychiatrists, they become salespersons for the drug companies.
Exactly.
They don't even know it.
Exactly.
But that's what they are. They're salespersons for the drug companies.
They have no idea how to taper. They don't tell you how to get off the drugs. I mean, I know this personally. I've experienced it myself. I've been traumatized, and it was rather, ignorant at the time. I should have been savvier, but that was
how
my
have
question.
You done, how have you done, Maria, how have you done recovering from the drugs? I mean, ECT.
Basically, I read your book. Because I went into a rehab and had 4 seizures. Okay, so because they stop you cold turkey, I pretty much know the whole scoop. I know exactly what they do. They give you Seroquel, which then makes you go a little nutsy. You start moving, agitated, so they say you're bipolar. And you come out of there worse than ever. However, in my case, I had 4 seizures. And even today, the students, medical students in psychiatry, are not getting that much training in pharmacology.
No, they're not. Well, they don't get honest training anyway. I mean, even if they go ahead and they become psychiatrists, maybe they even get a specialty of some sort in psychiatric drugs, they take a fellowship. They're being lied to all the time because it doesn't start out the first day with what it should be, which should be the opening statement on the course should be psychiatric drugs are neurotoxins. Never forget that, students, when you're using them. And of course, that's not how they begin at all. They begin with a pack of lies, and they don't tell them that the drug studies are too short to in any way assure safety in any way. They just don't start out learning anything. Maria, it's coming to the end. I hear the music. Thank you for calling in. Been a long time since I talked with you. Many, 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 many years. Thank you for calling in. Thank you, my wonderful audience. I needed you today. I needed to talk to you about the Westbecker case. Thanks for listening.